Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Daniel Williams. He's a research fellow at Corpus Christi College, University of Cambridge, and an associate fellow at the Lever-Eume Center for the Future of Intelligence. He works mostly in the philosophy of mind and psychology, and today we're going to talk about beliefs, misinformation, and other related topics. So, Dr. Williams, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks for the invitation, Ricardo.
So, let's start with beliefs then. So, from the perspective of philosophy of mind in this case, what is a belief?
Yeah, I would say there's no straightforward way to answer that question because the term belief is just used in lots of different ways, not just in philosophy, but across lots of other disciplines as well. So, at the most abstract level, you believe something if you take it to be true. So, I believe that Paris is the capital of France. I believe that if you drop something, it's going to fall to the ground. I believe I'm currently talking to a guy called Ricardo. Beyond that, there is just enormous controversy over how to understand belief. So I would say probably the most influential view in philosophy and the cognitive sciences views beliefs as the maps by which we steer, which is a quote from the philosopher Frank Ramsey. And there, the idea is beliefs are the sort of background model of reality that we use in navigating the world in thought and decision making. And they're sort of specialized for that navigational role. So, because the function of beliefs is to sort of track how things are, they tend to be pretty sensitive to evidence concerning how things are. And also because their function is to help us sort of navigate the world, we sort of tend to freely draw on our beliefs whenever their contents are relevant in thought and action guidance and so on. And I do think that picture is appropriate when it comes to sort of most of our beliefs. But there are some beliefs, or at least some things that are sort of core beliefs, especially in disciplines like anthropology and sociology, that don't really seem to fit that picture. So if you take the belief among Christians that like Jesus Christ is their savior, or the belief among the Mentawai people of Indonesia in like a powerful spirit that hunts people down if they don't share their meat, or the belief among like proponents of QAnon. I don't know whether you've got QAnon in Portugal, but it's the conspiracy theory that the
I've
world,
heard about it, at least. We've
yeah,
heard
right,
about it.
this conspiracy that the world is run by Satan worshipping cannibalistic pedophiles. So in that case, people are typically sincere when they say they hold the belief, so they're not lying for the most part. But nevertheless, the beliefs don't really seem to behave like sort of ordinary world modeling beliefs. So, like, people tend to be quite attached to the beliefs. They're not just sort of dispassionate assessments of how things are. They don't tend to be particularly sensitive to evidence, to put it mildly, in some cases. And they're also often sort of weirdly compartmentalized. So, somebody will say that they believe God is always watching, and they'll be sincere when they say that, but then they'll act in ways which suggest, like, deep down, they don't really think that's the case. So some philosophers want to say in those cases that means they don't really believe the relevant propositions. I prefer to say in my research they do believe them, but the beliefs have sort of interesting characteristics that we should try to explain. So I take a kind of minimalist view of belief in which you believe something if you sincerely take it to be true, and I don't assume that all beliefs have the same functions or same characteristics. But it's a bit of a sort of terminological issue. I think as long as you're clear about how you're using the term, it doesn't really matter very much.
And how do people form their beliefs? Where do they stem from? And I'm not implying here that they all come from the same source of, or sources, of course, but how does it happen?
Yeah, I would say, as you say, beliefs stem from lots of different sources, but in general, it's helpful to draw a distinction between two different kinds of cases. So I think for the most part, when we form beliefs, we're trying to get at the truth. So we're trying to like figure out the way the world is, either because we're just curious or because it's going to help us advance our goals in some way. And in those cases, the source of our beliefs is like typically evidence of some kind. And that could be like perceptual evidence, or it could be the evidence I get from somebody else in communication and social learning, but it's for the most part evidence of some kind. There's another kind of case, which is when we form beliefs not really to get at the truth, but because the beliefs serve some kind of practical function for us. And in those cases, which are typically called like motivated cognition in psychology, or sort of self-deception in everyday discourse, our beliefs stem not really from the world, but from our own sort of practical motivations and interests. So when Upton Sinclair quipped that it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it, that's a case where the beliefs are rooted not in the evidence, but in the individual's own sort of practical motivations and interests.
When we hold certain beliefs, does it have anything to do with their epistemic value? Is that something we take into account, or usually not, or sometimes yes?
So I would say, if by epistemological value you mean sort of factors which support the truth of our beliefs, or evidence and arguments that genuinely support their truth, what I would say is we always consciously feel like we base our beliefs on their epistemological value. That's really part of what it is to believe something. You know, if you didn't think that there were sort of grounds for the truth of your belief, in some sense you wouldn't really hold it as a belief. And I would say, in most cases, we're correct. So when we're forming our beliefs just to sort of build an accurate model of reality, in those cases, we really are basing our beliefs on sort of epistemic consideration. So, you know, I think there's milk in the fridge because there was milk in the fridge last time I checked, and I've been given no reason to change that belief. In other cases, though, which I refer to as sort of motivated cognition, cases in which we're motivated to believe something really for reasons independent of its truth, because it serves some kind of sort of emotional or social or material benefit for us. In those cases, like the source of the belief is not really anything epistemic, it's our own practical motivations and interests. But like a complicating factor is, even in those cases, and this is probably something we'll get to later on, we'll almost always rationalize our beliefs by appeal to genuinely epistemic considerations. So if you imagine that I'm a politician and I want to believe that an election was stolen because that protects my self-esteem and it advances my political interests. In that situation, the sort of source of my belief is practical, but nevertheless, what you'll find is somebody in that situation will rationalize the belief by appeal to like genuinely epistemic considerations. So they'll point to things like voter fraud and political corruption and so on. So there's that sort of complicating factor, which is that even when our beliefs aren't based on their epistemic value, from a conscious perspective, we uphold this sort of illusion of objectivity where we think that they are.
Should we approach beliefs at a social level? I mean, are they primarily social, or perhaps some of them are better understood at an individual level?
I would say for the most part, they're not social, in that, for the most part, I think when we're forming beliefs about the world, their function is really to represent the world accurately. And so those beliefs often concern the social world. So, you know, I believe I'm talking to you, in some sense, that's a belief which concerns the social world. But the function of the belief is to sort of accurately track how things are. And crucially, I think that's the case for all of the beliefs of other animals. So I think when the chimpanzees and bonobos have like complex representations or beliefs about the material and social structure of their environment, so you know where food is located, their position in the local dominance hierarchy, who they have alliances with, and I think the overwhelming majority of our beliefs are just like that. What's distinctive about our species is that I think that at least in some cases, we form beliefs that are social in the sense that their function is not really to represent the world accurately, it's to influence other individuals in advantageous ways. And in those cases, what my research I refer to as socially adaptive beliefs, they're sort of social in a really deep sense. It's not necessarily that they just concern the social world, although they typically do concern the social world. The idea is their function is social rather than just being representational.
And what is it that in your work you call, and to other people probably, socially adaptive beliefs?
Yeah, so at the most abstract level, a socially adaptive belief is just a belief that an individual forms because of its effects on other people, as contrasted with a case in which an individual forms a belief because they have good reasons for believing that it's true. And the kind of underlying motivation for that idea, I think, is pretty commonsensical. So human beings are these obsessively sort of ultra social animals where not just our practical success, but like our survival depends on how we influence other people, what kind of effects we have on other people. And obviously, the kinds of beliefs we hold are really relevant to those effects. And also, and this is where the concept of socially adaptive beliefs comes in, the kinds of beliefs which produce sort of advantageous social effects are sometimes just totally different from the kinds of beliefs that are best grounded in evidence and reasons. And so when you sort of capitulate to those social incentives, when you form a belief, not because it's well supported by evidence, but because it has desirable effects on other people, that's what in my research I refer to in terms of socially adaptive beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And what are the social functions of them?
Yeah, so I would say, again, at the most abstract level, socially adaptive beliefs serve social functions in that it's the effect of these beliefs on other people that explain why individuals form them. More specifically, I think that socially adaptive beliefs tend to perform like two very different kinds of social functions. This wasn't really clear to me when I wrote the paper, Socially Adaptive Belief, but it's sort of become clear in the past couple of years, which is that, so firstly, I think that, and this is an idea that goes back at least as far as Nietzsche, but you also find it in the work of Robert Trivers, who I think you've had on the podcast, and Richard Alexander. And it's the idea that we're biased towards beliefs that we benefit from propagating to other agents, precisely because just as the best salespeople are those who genuinely believe in the value of their product, we're often better at selling ideas if we genuinely believe those ideas. And so a consequence of that is we tend to sort of instinctively behave as our own defense lawyer or press secretary. And I think that kind of bias is really relevant when it comes to explaining many kinds of like self-serving, self-aggrandizing, self-justifying beliefs. There's another kind of social function, which I think is completely different from that. And this has been written about explicitly by people like Eric Funkhauser and Robin Hanson, but it's really implicit in lots of research in sociology and anthropology. And here the idea is sometimes we form beliefs not to get at the truth, but to sort of signal certain characteristics that we have. So our species is made up of like fanatical impression managers. We're constantly trying to influence what other individuals think about us. And so we shape our behavior at multiple scales to sort of signal what socially attractive characteristics we have and what kinds of allegiances we have to particular people and communities. And I'm very persuaded by the idea that at least in some cases, those signaling motivations, sort of, they don't just shape our outward behavior, they also shape like the very contents of our mental lives, including what we believe. And I think that kind of social function becomes really relevant when you get to sort of dysfunctional group cognition, cases in which groups are harboring, you know, bizarre, outlandish or irrational beliefs.
And how are these socially adaptive beliefs distinguished from other sources of bias?
Yeah, that's an important point because even though I do think socially adaptive beliefs constitute in some sense the most sort of interesting and consequential source of cognitive bias, they are only one source of cognitive bias. So in my research, I draw a distinction between sort of two fundamentally different reasons why it is that human cognition sometimes falls short of optimal performance. So on the one hand, I think there are just constraints of various kinds. So we are constrained creatures in, you know, we've got limited time and energy and computational resources and so on. So at best, we can be boundedly rational, to use that phrase from Herbert Simon. Also, the evolutionary process is constrained. So it's an optimization process, but it doesn't always give rise to optimal designs. And then thirdly, some constraints are just sort of intrinsic to certain tasks. So in some contexts, the only way you can really avoid a like devastating error is by being biased towards less costly errors. So in evolutionary psychology, that's sometimes called the smoke detector principle. The idea being if a false negative would be devastating, for example, judging that there's not a predator there when there is, we're often a kind of like hair trigger alert for the relevant thing, and that can bias us towards false positives. There's another source of cognitive bias, which is fundamentally different from constraints. And this arises when you've got what I was referring to as motivated cognition, cases in which the reason why cognition falls short of optimality from the perspective of pursuing the truth is because in some sense, we're not really trying to get at the truth. We're forming beliefs because they serve some kind of practical function for us. And socially adaptive belief is sort of one category of motivated cognition, so described, but importantly, not the only kind of motivated cognition. So sometimes we convince ourselves of things just because, you know, they make us feel good or they're motivating or something like that. And that's really the kind of dominant explanatory paradigm in social psychology. So in social psychology, you often find people trying to explain biased beliefs by appeal to things like self-esteem regulation, reducing cognitive dissonance, producing reassuring feelings of control and so on. I think that stuff gets massively overplayed. I think socially adaptive beliefs are a much more consequential source of cognitive bias. And that's where motivated cognition is not really driven by, you know, emotion regulation. It's driven by social goals of, you know, persuasion, influence, reputation management, and signaling and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
So still related to socially adaptive beliefs, I would like to ask you now how this knowledge about them might connect and help us understand better other psychological mechanisms like confabulation, rationalization, positive illusions, and so on. So starting with confabulation and rationalization, does in fact acquiring more knowledge about the socially adaptive beliefs, does it allow for us to get a better understanding of how these phenomena work?
Yeah, so it's probably first worth saying what confabulation is. So We confabulate when we give sort of sincere but nevertheless fabricated explanations of our actions and our attitudes. So, you know, you ask me like why I do something or why did I become a philosopher or whatever it might be, and I give you an answer, and the answer is sincere. I sort of genuinely believe what I'm saying, but nevertheless it's mistaken. And I think it's been sort of common wisdom, at least since people like Nietzsche and Freud, that confabulation in that sense is just completely rampant. And I think there's also lots of experimental data which shows that confabulation is ubiquitous as well. Now, the sort of standard explanation of this tendency to confabulate in lots of psychology is a purely epistemic one, where the idea is the reason why we confabulate is because we've got no introspective access to the causes of our actions and our attitudes. And so even though we're sort of aiming at the truth, we're aiming to give an accurate representation of what's driving our behavior, because we've got limited information, sometimes we're mistaken. I think, and here I'm drawing on the work of people like Philip Tetlock, Jonathan Haidt, Hugo Mercier, Dan Sperber, Robert Kurzban, people like that, I think actually confabulations are much better understood as a certain kind of socially adaptive belief, where the idea is we explain our actions and attitudes in ways that are really optimized, not for accuracy, but for social consumption. And I think the sort of theoretical reason for taking that seriously is, you know, as I mentioned, we are these obsessively social animals, and we have to navigate these sort of norm-governed worlds where our success depends on persuading individuals in our environment that we have conformed to local social norms and social expectations. And I think confabulations are just one of the ways by which we influence those impressions. So there's this idea that we, you know, carry around a press secretary on our back at all times, sort of churning out explanations of our behavior that make us look good. And I think, you know, one reason for preferring that explanation to the purely epistemic one is the epistemic explanation doesn't really explain confabulations. It kind of just re-describes the phenomenon that we're trying to explain. So it says the reason why we confabulate is because we're ignorant of the causes of our actions and our attitudes, but we don't know that we're ignorant. But that's the very thing that we're trying to explain, any elimination of that. And then more importantly, I think there is just this like striking mismatch between the sort of self-serving, status-enhancing motivations that actually drive a lot of human behavior, and then the way in which people intuitively understand and explain their behavior, which is almost always pro-social, moral, rational, and so on. And that kind of systematic misalignment, I think, is easy to understand if you recognize that confabulations have social functions, much more difficult to understand if you think that their function is just accurate representation.
Mm-hmm. What about positive illusions? First of all, what are positive illusions, and are they connected in any way also to these socially adaptive beliefs?
So positive illusions are beliefs that you tend to find in weird populations, so Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic populations, that involve tendencies towards sort of self-aggrandizement. So we often believe that we've got sort of socially attractive characteristics. Famously, the average person believes themselves to be better than average with respect to just about every socially attractive trait, more courageous, more thoughtful, more intelligent than the average person. And also optimistic beliefs about the future and our ability to control the environment, but only for good outcomes. When it comes to bad outcomes, then we tend to externalize responsibility. Now, lots of psychology going back to the 80s explains these illusions in a really individualistic way. The idea is we form these beliefs because they protect our self-esteem, you know, they help us get out of bed in the morning, they help us be motivated to pursue long-term projects and so on. Whereas again, I think, and here I'm really drawing on the work of, say, Robert Trivers or Robert Kurzban, that actually positive illusions are much better understood as a certain kind of socially adaptive belief, where the idea is we tend to be biased towards sort of self-enhancing, optimistic beliefs because it benefits us to persuade other individuals of self-serving and optimistic truths when it comes to ourselves. And I think there are various reasons for preferring that social explanation to the standard individualistic one. One is that, and this kind of applies to lots of research in social psychology, the individualistic explanation doesn't really make any sense from an evolutionary perspective. Evolution doesn't care about how you feel. So if you just hold the effects on other people constant, an individual who's got a more accurate model of the world would be at a sort of competitive advantage to an individual who doesn't. But also, even if you're not persuaded by those sorts of evolutionary considerations, I just think the social account explains the sort of patterns in socially adapt in positive illusions much better. So for one thing, people aren't generally biased towards positive views. They only tend to be biased towards positive or optimistic views when their self-image is at stake, right? When it's reality more generally, that effect tends to go away, as the research of people like Michael Thaler has shown. But also, and this wasn't, I think, particularly clear sort of 5 or 10 years ago, but I think it's come to light since. As I mentioned, you really only find positive illusions or a certain kind of positive illusions in weird populations or hyper-individualistic societies like the UK and the US. In much more collectivist cultures, what you find is that tendencies towards self-aggrandizement are, if anything, selected against, and people tend to be self-deflating and humble. And instead, what they'll do is inflate the character of their relationships with other people. And that makes sense from a social perspective, because in individualistic societies where we're constantly trying to sell ourselves on various kinds of friendship and cooperation markets, it obviously benefits us to be very kind of self-aggrandizing, to advertise what kinds of good characteristics we've got. Whereas in much more collectivist cultures, where you've got sort of tighter kinship networks and predetermined roles and obligations, that kind of advertising is not advantageous at all. So I think the social perspective can explain that kind of variation in a way that I think, you know, I've got no idea how a purely individualistic account would illuminate that.
Mm-hmm. So before we change topics, just one last aspect of our psychology that might be related to socially adaptive belief. So what is identity protective cognition and what's the relationship there?
Yeah, so identity protective cognition is a term that I think was invented by Dan Kahan, but it's an idea that you find all over the place in sociology, anthropology, evolutionary psychology, and other fields. And it's just the idea that, you know, human beings are not just profoundly social, we're like profoundly groupish or coalitional. So we form, you know, cooperative communities and groups and subcultures of various kinds. And when we do that and we have a kind of practical stake in the success and status of that group, we care deeply about being welcomed into and approved of within that community. And that means whenever a group, and that could be a religious community or like a subculture or a political party, becomes organized around sort of identity defining beliefs. So beliefs or narratives or worldviews that sort of mark you out as a good community member. Anyone who cares about their status within that group acquires a kind of practical stake in holding and affirming those beliefs. And so I think that's a case of socially adaptive belief, because I think what's going on in those cases is individuals, in effect, forming and maintaining and affirming their commitment to those beliefs in order to sort of signal their membership of an allegiance to the relevant community. And so you've got this phenomenon of identity protective cognition whenever there's this kind of conflict between, on the one hand, forming accurate beliefs about the world, and on the other hand, being welcomed into a community that, you know, we care about and that we care about our connection and status within. And Kahan uses that primarily to explain certain kinds of misperceptions and misinformation about topics like science and polarized along political and cultural lines. But I think the basic idea applies much more generally. It applies to religious communities and like sects and cults. And also, we might get to this later on, communities organized around bizarre conspiracy theories. Whenever you've got identity-defining beliefs for a community that people care about their status within, you're also going to have this phenomenon of identity-protective cognition.
Now changing topics, what are rationalization markets? And is this a term that you yourself coined or not?
Well, I think the first time I came across the term rationalization market was in Hugo Mercier's book, Not Born Yesterday, where he uses market for justifications in a slightly different sense, although his work has been extremely influential in how I think about rationalization markets. And I think it's useful to start with like the general idea of an information market. So an information market is any kind of social system in which individuals can stand to benefit from producing and disseminating like high quality, socially valued information. And those benefits might be like financial. You might subscribe to the New York Times because it's a good source of information. They might be attentional. So if you're a like high quality source of information, people will attend to you, and then you can often sell that attention off to advertisers. But much more often in sort of informal social contexts, the benefits are just sort of social rewards. So think of the gratitude you feel when somebody gives you good advice or juicy gossip, or you know, the admiration you have for somebody who makes an insightful point or an intellectual contribution. And it's those sort of financial and social rewards which motivate people very often to sort of do the cognitive labor, do the work required to produce socially valued information. Now, in most cases, we're trying to seek out information to build up an accurate model of the world. And so information markets cater to that demand, and they produce and disseminate sort of accurate decision-relevant information. There's another kind of case, which is when we're forming beliefs, as I mentioned earlier on, not really to get at the truth, but because the belief has some kind of practical benefit for us. But crucially, in those cases of motivated cognition, it's subject to a kind of rationalization constraint, in the sense that you can really only convince yourself of a belief for which you can find sort of appropriate post hoc rationalizations. Now, most research in psychology assumes that the task of producing those rationalizations falls on the individual engaging in motivated cognition and their own psychological acrobatics, you know, Freudian defense mechanisms or cognitive biases or whatever it might be. But in many cases, motives to form unfounded beliefs are sort of widely distributed among members of a group. Whenever you've got identity protective cognition, you've got a group of people who are in effect seeking out rationalizations of shared beliefs or narratives. And a rationalization market is just an information economy which emerges to satisfy that demand, where in this context, individuals benefit not from producing sort of accurate decision-relevant information, but from sort of churning out high-quality intellectual ammunition which is tailored to justifying the favored conclusions and narratives of different groups in society. That's the sort of general idea. I realize that's really abstract, so I can go into that in more concrete detail if that'd be helpful.
Yeah, perhaps an example would be good here. How do these rationalization markets apply in political contexts, for example?
So politics is like fundamentally about groups, political parties, activist coalitions, subcultures, social classes, and so on, and sort of competition and conflict between those groups for power, status, and influence. And as I mentioned, human beings are just intensely groupish. And whenever we form an attachment to one of those groups, we tend to be sort of strongly motivated to view the world in ways that reflect favorably on the group and that sort of signal our membership of and allegiance to it. So what you tend to find in politics is all of these competing political, social, cultural groups that have their own sort of widespread within group demand for rationalizations of their favorite narrative. So politics almost always produces this sort of marketplace of rationalizations. And I think that helps to explain lots of characteristics and effects of political and cultural media. So one thing it explains is why political and cultural media is very often sort of highly polarized and segmented, and why the information producers in that domain are often extremely biased. They behave a lot more like defense lawyers than they do as sort of idealized truth-seeking scientists. And also, the idea of rationalization markets should make you think of competition. So just as sort of well-functioning competitive markets in general select for the production of like high-quality goods, rationalization markets select for the emergence of a class of people, you know, intellectuals, social media, micro-influencers, journalists, pundits, and so on, who are just incredibly skilled at framing, packaging, interpreting reality in ways that support the favored narratives of different political and cultural groups. And what keeps that demand for rationalizations like really, really strong and really intense is that the favored narratives or beliefs of every group is sort of coming under constant epistemic threat from the competing narratives and arguments and challenges of other groups. And then finally, I think one thing that this kind of construct helps you to explain is why it is that many people in politics, especially that sort of minority of the population who are very high in political engagement, can consume an enormous amount of political content and information without ever revising their foundational beliefs about the world. And the reason they can do that is because, in some sense, much of the information that they're consuming isn't really there to provide them with an accurate picture of the world. It's really there just to provide them with intellectual arguments and evidence that support, in some sense, what they already believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even when the information goes against their beliefs, they sometimes can reinterpret it. Right.
Exactly, yeah. And I would say, actually, rationalization producers are incredibly skilled at doing that for them. So, you know, you tune into your favorite pundit or journalist, whoever it might be, and they're incredibly good at taking what looks to be an objection to your group's narrative, and as you say, framing it and packaging it in such a way that the kind of threat is undermined. Mm-hmm.
And does this construct also help us understand specifically misinformation?
I would say, on the one hand, it helps us illuminate the function of lots of forms of misinformation. So if you take the misinformation that, you know, Obama was really, you know, a Muslim socialist, or the misinformation that the only reason Donald Trump won the 2016 election was because of Russian interference, right? In those cases, the misinformation is tailor-made to justifying partisan narratives. But I think much more importantly, the concept of rationalization markets just provides a much better framework for understanding lots of sort of epistemic dysfunction in political and cultural media than the concept of misinformation. So at least since 2016, there's been this growing panic and alarm about misinformation. And I'm very sympathetic to the views of people like Hugo Mercier and Sacha Olthaille, who I know you've had on the podcast, that much of this panic is really misguided. When you look at the data, especially in countries where this has been intensively studied, like the UK and the US and lots of Western Europe, the share of misinformation in most people's information diet is like pretty minimal. And that small minority of the population that does consume a lot of misinformation tend to be like hyper-partisans or dogmatists anyway. So it looks like they're not really being informed by the misinformation. They're just sort of seeking out stuff that already that rationalizes what they already believe. And then also, I just think the sort of popular image of human beings as being gullible consumers of misinformation is very implausible on evolutionary grounds. And it's just at odds with our best cognitive science of social learning. I think, you know, the so-called Paris School of Cultural Evolution, I think, has shown that really, really clearly. But having said all of that, I think it's pretty difficult to deny that when it comes to politics and culture wars, people are often pretty ignorant and misinformed about the world, even if their rate of exposure to misinformation is quite low. And also the kinds of information which is viral and gets spread and consumed, even if it's not strictly speaking misinformation in the sense of false claims about the world, it's often pretty bad quality, pretty biased, pretty partial, and so on. And I think the concept of rationalization markets helps to illuminate that situation, because rationalizations are not the same thing as misinformation. You can't rationalize your belief with information which you know to be false. And that's kind of obvious if you think about defense lawyers. So a really good defense lawyer doesn't just make stuff up. they're really good at like packaging, framing, interpreting the facts to support a predetermined narrative. And that's how I think lots of political and cultural media should be understood. It's not that it's just filled with misinformation, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily good from an epistemological point of view, because lots of the information isn't really there to inform people concerning the state of the world. It's there to provide them with evidence and arguments that support what are often like pretty misleading ideological narratives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you said, for the past year or so, I interviewed for the show several different people to talk exactly about some of what you mentioned there, Hugo Mercier, Sasha Altai, Christopher Bale, and others. So, I mean, do you think that with what we know from cognitive science specifically about misinformation, let's call it that, we should drop the term and perhaps use another one because of what it's been associated with?
Yeah, maybe we should, yeah. I mean, what I would say is I think part of the problem with the term is in some contexts it has a relatively strict and narrow definition, which is typically something like, you know, false or unsubstantiated claims about the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of definition can be useful, but once you've got that definition, the misinformation panic is incredibly misguided. Sometimes the term misinformation is just used for, you know, any kind of information which is at all misleading in some way. And then I would say I agree with you, the term has become so general and nebulous that it's not particularly useful from a theoretical perspective. And I'd also say I think there's something misguided about the very idea that you're going to be able to define what's wrong with misinformation purely in terms of its content. I think a much better framework is often to focus not so much on the content or the truth value of the information, but its function. So that helps you look at the sort of broader function of a whole information ecosystem. So the nice thing about the idea of rationalization markets is a rationalization is, in a sense, not defined by the content of information or by its truth value, but by its function. Is the reason why people are producing and consuming that information because they're trying to get at the truth, or is it because they're trying just to justify, rationalize, sort of predetermined conclusions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems to me particularly interesting that even if sometimes people ring the bells because there's some sort of alarm about misinformation, for example, during the COVID-19 pandemic about vaccines, it could be the case that many more people than the ones that really do not take the vaccines believe some of the information that's circulating on the internet about the supposed secondary or adverse effects of vaccination in this case. But even then, it seems that it doesn't have the behavioral effects that people would suppose, right? And there's very, very few people that really do not take any vaccines at all, right? For example.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you tend to find, you know, a relatively small minority of the population, basically whenever you have vaccinations across different countries, which you're probably never going to reach, maybe like 5% or something like that. But as you say, there are lots of other people who will sort of mouth off about vaccine risks, but then still get vaccinated. Although I would say, you know, I don't want to go the extreme route of saying misinformation never matters. I think, you know, it does sometimes matter, and it's good that people are studying it, and it's good that people are trying to combat it. I just think that there's a certain narrative about misinformation, which is misguided both in terms of the data we have about misinformation itself, and also in terms of what we know about human psychology. It tends to be underpinned by this picture of human beings as irrational and credulous, when actually I think human beings are rational and vigilant, which is exactly what you would expect them to be on even sort of a moderate application of evolutionary theory to cognitive science.
And perhaps another issue here is that even if sometimes misinformation might have negative effects on people's behavior concerning whatever kind of topic, if you do not study it rigorously, then you can't really tackle the issue, right? But if you just say that people are gullible and stupid and That's why they believe any kind of information they find on the internet, then that doesn't help at all, right?
I completely agree. And I think actually the sort of the new science of misinformation, which has erupted in recent years, I think has been not always, and there's lots of incredibly good research within that tradition, but it's been sort of tainted by what I would regard as not particularly scientific ideas, some of which have an almost motivation. So I think when things like Brexit happened and things like Trump happened, many people were just caught by surprise, especially many members of sort of the elite commentariat and intellectuals and scientists and so on. And I think one very convenient narrative was people have been duped by misinformation, and that's led them to make decisions that we don't like. And I think that in combination with a widespread but misguided view of people as being gullible and stupid and irrational and so on, even when it's not explicitly framed in that way, has played a significant part in, you know, turning this study of misinformation into something incredibly influential. And I agree with you, even when it's a problem, it's really important to address it in a way which is sort of grounded in an empirical scientific mindset.
Mm-hmm. So where do absurd beliefs come from?
Yeah, the first thing probably to say is, so what I mean in my research by absurd belief. So as I define the term, absurd beliefs are beliefs that aren't just sort of mildly or moderately irrational, but seem, at least to those who don't hold the beliefs, to be kind of extremely irrational, extremely at odds with evidence and reasons that the individuals have at their disposal. But nevertheless, they're not the product of any kind of pathology or illness or dysfunction. So the individual isn't suffering from a kind of psychotic disorder or anything like that. So I mentioned earlier on QAnon, you know, the belief that the world is run by Satan-worshipping cannibalistic pedophiles. That's probably a good example of the kind of thing I'm talking about in many cases. And I'd also say at least certain kinds of religious beliefs probably are as well. You know, if you literally believe that you're currently drinking the blood of a man who's both God, but also the son of God and whose mother was a virgin. So those outside of that community of co-believers, that seems like a very strange thing to believe. So absurd beliefs raise this kind of explanatory puzzle, which is why do well-functioning, psychologically healthy, sometimes even sort of flourishing individuals form beliefs that seem just extremely irrational? And that's especially puzzling if you think, as many philosophers and cognitive scientists do, that the function of beliefs is to represent the world accurately. So I've explored the idea in my research, drawing on the work of people like Richard Sosis and Robert Kurtzban and Robin Hanson, Hugo Mercier, lots of people that you've had on the show, that at least in some cases, it could be that these absurd beliefs are really a certain kind of socially adaptive belief that I call strategic absurdities, where the idea is, even though the beliefs look extremely irrational, there's actually this kind of underlying social rationality to them, in that they're functioning as signals of commitment or loyalty to a community of co-believers, where the reason why they're credible signals of group commitment is precisely because they're viewed as absurd or insane or stupid or irrational by outsiders. I mean, I don't know whether that's true. I think it's a bit speculative, and I think much more research is required on that, but it's at least one candid explanation for why it is that, you know, otherwise psychologically healthy people sometimes endorse these seemingly quite bizarre beliefs.
Are these absurd beliefs best explained by signaling theory?
Yeah, so I think that's the sort of general idea that I explore in that paper. So signaling theory tries to explain what is it that makes signals, and that's sort of anything that has the function of conveying information, honest under some conditions, or under conditions where some agents would benefit from sending the signal dishonestly, which is basically whenever you have communication between people. And one context where that arises is in sort of cooperative groups or coalitions. So, as I mentioned, human beings are these intensely coalitional animals. We form these cooperative communities. And we do that because these communities provide various kinds of benefits to those who belong to them in the form of things like social support and mutual aid, and the favor of in-group members and sort of opportunities for collective action. But because those benefits sort of depend on the cooperation of members of the community, they're really vulnerable to free riders, sort of individuals who will reap those benefits without themselves paying any of the costs of cooperation required to sustain them for other people. The sort of free ride on other people's cooperative investments. So what you tend to find with coalitions is they're very sort of vigilant towards new recruits, and it's often really important for people who want to join a coalition to signal that they're going to be committed and loyal group members before they get access to its benefits, the benefits of the group. And that's where signaling theory comes in, because you can't just say that you're going to be a committed and loyal group member, because anybody can say that. Talk is cheap. So you need some way of making that signal honest. And there's lots of research in the social sciences on how cooperative groups solve that problem. And one idea that you find there is, in some contexts, acts and traits can credibly signal commitment to one group by sort of selectively harming the individual's reputation in the eyes of those outside of the group. So the sort of game theoretic logic here has been nicely described by Hugo Mercier, and it's the idea that just as a sort of invading army can commit and so credibly signal a commitment to fight on in a war by burning the bridges behind it, you can credibly signal to a community that you're going to be committed to it by sort of metaphorically burning your bridges to the outside social world. And I think there's work in the economics of religion, which I think pretty successfully demonstrates that this strategy is at play when it comes to lots of group distinctive clothing and behavior and conduct. So you often find sort of cults and sects and subcultures that have their own sort of group distinctive conduct, which is stigmatized by those outside of the group as being sort of weird or odd or bizarre. And I think in many of those cases, that's a kind of feature, not a bug, right? That's playing this kind of signaling role. And what I try to do in the strategic absurdity paper is explore the idea that that kind of game theoretic signaling logic might also extend to certain kinds of beliefs where they're functioning as credible signals of group commitment, precisely because they selectively harm the individual's reputation in the eyes of those outside of the community. I should say, though, I do think that's just one way in which groups can, in which beliefs can signal group commitment. So I think another way, and you find this in the work of John Toobey, is that sometimes a belief can signal group identity, not because it's viewed as absurd by outsiders, but just because it's sort of group distinctive. So if you take the belief that Paris is the capital of France, that will be a terrible marker of group identity because everyone believes that, no matter what group they belong to. Whereas if you take the belief that you've got some relationship with a supernatural deity, people aren't going to just stumble on that belief in the course of trying to figure out the way the world is. So it can perform this useful role of differentiating in-group members from outsiders. And then finally, and I think this is actually probably a much more widespread phenomenon, in some cases, beliefs signal group commitment just because there's a relationship between their content and being committed to the group. So if you believe that your group is the best, or you believe that your group is great, as you find in racism and nationalism and ethnocentrism and so on, that signals commitment to your group, because if you genuinely believe that, then you are in fact likely to be committed to your group. And similarly, if you believe that there is some supernatural deity who's going to reward you for conforming to your group's rules and will punish you if you deviate from those norms, that can also signal that you're a cooperative group member, because if you genuinely believe that, you're going to be more likely to cooperate. So those cases, I think, are kind of more widespread and in some ways more plausible than the idea of strategic absurdities, where they're signaling group commitment not because there's this sort of bridge burning function, but because there's this relationship between their content and certain kinds of behaviors.
So, for the last part of this interview, I would like to ask you about irrationality and motivated cognition. So, how would you define irrationality? Because, to be honest, as the years go on and I talk with more and more people, particularly cognitive scientists, anthropologists, and evolutionary theorists, it's become harder and harder for me to really say that a particular belief is irrational, because it seems to me that most of the time they have at least some sort of functionality, social functionality, particularly. So, how would you define it?
It really is a difficult subject. The first thing to say is it's crucial to distinguish between two different kinds of irrationality. So, for the most part, I've been talking about epistemic irrationality, irrationality sort of relative to epistemic goals of forming true beliefs or acquiring knowledge. And in that situation, you are irrational if you are evaluating evidence, thinking and reasoning in ways which are not conducive to forming true beliefs. And it's an incredibly difficult question how exactly to quantify and measure that phenomenon. But I think it's pretty commonsensical and pretty difficult to deny that there are just better and worse ways of forming beliefs about the world if your goal is to get at the truth. And sometimes people fall short of the optimal way of doing that. There's another kind of irrationality which should be kept completely distinct from that, which is instrumental irrationality, where you're irrational if you're not pursuing effective means to achieve your goals. The reason it's crucial to distinguish between those kinds of irrationality is because people often assume, mistakenly, that if somebody is epistemically irrational, if they're thinking and reasoning in ways which aren't conducive to forming true beliefs, that means they must be making some kind of mistake or an error of some kind. Whereas, actually, as you say, many kinds of epistemic irrationality are really functional for the individual. They're a kind of instrumentally rational response to the incentives that the individual confronts. It's kind of strategic irrationality. And that's definitely how I think you should understand socially adaptive beliefs. They're not rational from an epistemic point of view, but they are rational from the perspective of hypersocial animals who care about their status and reputation and membership of different communities. And I think the idea of beliefs functioning as signals of group identity kind of illustrates that idea on steroids. So if you take the QAnon belief that the world is run by Satan-worshipping cannibalistic paedophiles, right? I think from an epistemological point of view, difficult to deny that that's irrational. It seems like there's no evidence for it, lots of evidence against it. But if the function of that belief is to mark you out as a good and loyal member of a kind of fringe extremist subculture, there can be this kind of underlying rationality to it. So it's really crucial to distinguish between those kinds of rationality.
Yeah, I think that's why I said it has become more and more difficult for me to really attach the label irrational to most beliefs out there because of this sort of social functionality, at least that many, if not most of them have.
I completely agree. And I'd actually say, increasingly in my research, I think it's just unhelpful to talk about rationality because it does cause this confusion. So, I think human beings are extremely rational. I think there's lots of evidence to the effect that we are. I think that the sort of standard view in behavioral economics and social psychology, which depicts us as just hopelessly flawed, is really mistaken. And I think you would just expect us to be rational on evolutionary grounds. But as you say, that's consistent with thinking that sometimes when we form beliefs, we're not particularly good at getting at the truth. And the reason we're not is because we're rational in the sense at which we're good at achieving the kinds of goals that we evolved to achieve. And those goals are sometimes different from the ones that behavioral economists and psychologists assume, often mistakenly, that we're aiming at.
So motivated cognition then, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's come up a few times, and it's probably worth saying a bit about what it is technically. So, in common sense terms, motivated cognition is just believing what you want to believe rather than believing that which is best supported by your evidence. But more technically, it's unconsciously conforming sort of how you seek out, interpret, and process information to sort of non-epistemic goals, goals which are independent of the acquisition of knowledge. Where in psychology, they're typically called directional goals, because the idea is you are directing belief formation towards some favored conclusion rather than just letting the available evidence speak for itself. And there's loads of research in psychology on the subtle ways in which we strategically bias how we seek out and process information in the context of motivated cognition. So things like selective exposure, we sort of actively seek out evidence that confirms our desired belief. There's biased evaluation. We tend to give a kind of free pass to any evidence that supports our desired belief, but subject any counter evidence to intense scrutiny. there's selective forgetting, kind of self-explanatory, and so on. I would say, I mean, much of my research at the moment is pointing out that too much of this research on motivated cognition is individualistic. I think very often the way in which we convince ourselves of unfounded beliefs is not just through cognitive biases, but through sort of social scaffolding. That's what the idea of rationalization markets is getting at. And then I'll just say one final thing, which is that in psychology, motivated cognition is typically referred to as hot cognition, because the idea is it involves like affect or feelings of some kind. And in general, sort of motivational systems in the brain work by exploiting positive and negative feelings, affective states, to track sort of progress towards and obstacles in the way of particular goals that we're pursuing. And that carries over to motivated cognition. So I think when you're motivated to reach a particular conclusion, encountering any information or arguments that supports that conclusion generates like positively valenced affective states. It feels good, sort of nice experience of vindication. Whereas encountering evidence against what you want to believe is aversive. It generates anxiety, you know, anger, frustration, and so on. And it's this kind of affect regulation, which I think is ultimately what drives how people think and reason when it comes to motivated cognition.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular cases where ignorance might be rational?
So the term rational ignorance in social science refers to cases where the costs of becoming informed outweigh the benefits of being informed. So I would love to know about quantum mechanics, but I'm not sufficiently intelligent and it would take me loads of time and energy to acquire that knowledge. So for me, the costs of acquiring the knowledge outweigh the benefits of possessing it. And that's what social scientists typically mean when they say rational ignorance. I'm much more interested in a different phenomenon, which is motivated ignorance, mm-hmm. which arises when the individual judges that the costs of being informed outweigh the benefits of being informed. So it's not just that they're avoiding the costs of acquiring the knowledge, they're kind of going out of their way to avoid being knowledgeable about the particular topic. And in the context of that form of motivated ignorance, I think the same kind of cost-benefit analysis applies. So motivated ignorance is rational if it is in fact the case that the costs of being informed outweigh the benefits of being informed. And many cases of motivated ignorance don't satisfy that condition. So, you know, if I avoid learning about my financial situation because it makes me anxious, and as a consequence of that, I go into financial ruin, that's a form of irrational motivated ignorance. You might think all cases of motivated ignorance are like that. And we've got lots of phrases of sort of common sense discourse, like burying your head in the sand, which capture that intuition. But actually, I think there are loads of forms of motivated ignorance, especially in a social context, which advance the relevant individual's interests, especially in two kinds of cases. So in some cases, we seek to remain ignorant to avoid accountability for our actions and to so sort of maintain plausible deniability. You often find that in institutions of various kinds, where people will kind of remain strategically ignorant of what's going on within the institution so that they can convincingly say they didn't know what was going on. And then also, I think you find this in the context of what I was talking about earlier with identity protective cognition, where if you form part of a group that's organized around identity defining beliefs, you'll often be motivated to remain ignorant of any kind of knowledge which is in tension with those beliefs in order to sort of maintain good, stable relationship with other people in the community. And in those kinds of cases, I think they might be undesirable from a social and a political point of view, but they're nevertheless often instrumentally rational.
One last question then. How does this motivated ignorance play out in a political context?
I think it plays out in a few ways, but one of the most consequential, and this has been written about by people like Charles Mills and Michelle Moody Adams, but in some ways it goes back to Marx. And it's the idea that in hierarchically organized societies, so think white supremacy, patriarchy, India's caste-based system, whenever you have a society which is organized around relationships of sort of domination and subordination between different groups, you tend to find members of the elite groups remaining kind of strategically ignorant of the conditions of the society and how bad it is for those who are in marginalized or oppressed groups. And plausibly, that's because that enables them to maintain a kind of positive moral self-image and avoid any accountability or complicity or feeling of complicity in the injustice of the system. There's another kind of phenomenon which I've written mostly about, which arises, as I was saying, in the context of identity protective cognition. So whenever you're finding political, cultural, class-based or social groups organized around certain kinds of identity-defining worldviews, anyone who cares about their status within the group typically tries to remain, even if this is unconscious, ignorant of any knowledge which would threaten those relationships. I think a really good example of this is, in recent decades, at least some kind of environmentalist movements have been really ignorant on the topic of nuclear power. They've massively inflated the risks of nuclear energy, and they haven't fully appreciated its clear benefits from the perspective of climate change. And you might reasonably ask yourself, like, how could it be that people whose stated goal was environmentalism and who invested lots of time and energy into it could remain ignorant on that topic? And I think part of the explanation is, for complicated reasons, being anti-nuclear power became a kind of badge of group identity within these activist coalitions. And individuals within those communities, somewhat selfishly, but also understandably from a human perspective, in effect chose their status and recognition within these communities over the pursuit of truth. And I think that's just one example, but I think that general phenomenon is incredibly widespread and extremely consequential whenever you've got political or cultural groups organized around like shared identity defining beliefs or narratives.
So, Dr. Williams, before we go, would you like to tell people where they can find your work on the internet?
So, my website is danwilliamsphilosophy.com, and I am pretty active on Twitter at, I think, danwilliamsphil.
Yeah, I will be leaving links and your Twitter handle in the description box of this interview so that people can check it out. Dr. Williams, thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for the invitation, Ricardo. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so...
I really appreciate it.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this episode until the end. To keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and consider making a pledge there, starting at $1 per month. You also have links to PayPal. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. The show is brought to you by Enlights, learning and development done differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett Perga, Larson, Lau Guerrero, Francis Fordens, Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf, Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whitting, Bernardo Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegar, Rui Nassio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurban, Simon Colombo, Jorge Pinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguenzo, Mikkel Stormir, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugnig, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cussen, Yevon Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Oslin Bullitt, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Weira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dermiti Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Alec Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Elman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Simon Fazal, Adrian Yegi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Brunner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litzke, Denise Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Todd Shackelford, and Sonny Smith. My producers is our web, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Ian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Vanek, Dam Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, Sardus France, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivet. Thank you for all.